Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, co-host Jake Towne here as well, and Bill G, sitting in once again for Gene DiNardo, who's off this week. But we're welcoming Jake back after a week off, and here are some of the headlines we're looking at today. We're going to be talking quite a bit about what's going on with the LIBOR manipulation probe and various headlines that are related to that that have come out this week. We're going to look at what the central banks are saying, not only about that, but also about what's happening with the economy, both in Europe and here in the United States. We're going to take a look at what's happening with the sovereign debt difficulties of Spain and Italy and how that's playing out in the marketplace. We're going to take a look at the impact of the housing crisis and how it's impacted older Americans as well as children, and why some cities, perhaps out in California, may actually try to seize mortgages as a way to solve the problem. Not so sure how much of a solution that's going to be, but we'll be looking at that too. We will look briefly at what's going on with the Syrian revolution, but we're going to start off at the top of the hour with the last confrontation between Chairman Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve and Congressman Ron Paul in the U.S. House of Representatives, the last time Bernanke has to testify before Paul leaves office. He has decided, as many people know, to leave after this term of office is over. He's basically done with his political career. He's retired, ready to go. And Ben Bernanke, in his testimony this week, what he did not say but probably wanted to say was, yeah, you can't get me anymore. But what he actually said was that, in his opinion, it is a bad idea to have an audit the Fed bill because the Federal Reserve has a long history of doing such a good job of keeping the economy basically level and steady and has actually done very much good with it, which we've kind of beaten that dead horse quite a bit, Jake, but let's flay it one more time. Can you think of anything that's really good that has come out of Fed control of the economy and of its independence that is the supposed basis for this tremendous growth and opportunity and wonderful prosperity it has created?
No, I mean, everything's kind of come out of the Fed has been, relatively evil. I mean, we talk about that on the show all the time, whether it's destroying the private sector or emitting the dollar bills, which are really toxic waste due to all the heavy metals that are in them. You know, they're a toxic waste supplier, but they're also a toxic debt supplier. And as a money printing center for the world, they really have, at the end of the day, they're holding back mankind or really our society from moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Now, Bill, you are here now for your second week, and welcome back. Glad you decided not to be scared away by your first week's experience.
No problem.
But what's your take on it? When Mr. Bernanke said that the independence of the Fed has done all these wonderful things and that there's all this evidence to support it, what do you think? Do you agree? Do you think there's evidence to support it?
Well, okay, this is my take on it, is if Mr. Bernanke believes that the Federal Reserve has done all this good all throughout its history and whatever, why is he afraid of an audit? Every accounting entity out there has to be audited. They have to have audited financial statements in order to be a publicly traded company. Every bank has to have a audited financial statement. Why can't the Federal Reserve have an audited statement? So either they're trying to hide something, or they just feel that they're above the law, or just above everybody else. And if you truly think that you have made the world a better place, prove it through an audit.
Now, I'm going to do something I really hate to do. I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm actually going to take Mr. Bernanke's position because this is essentially what he said in his testimony. Mm-hmm. He said that the Fed does get audited. It's a regular thing for the Fed to get audited. And what the audit the Fed bill is really all about, and he said it was a misnamed bill, it's really all about auditing monetary policy, and that's the part that should be kept secret because that's the part that needs to be secret so that the economy can function the way it's supposed to function. That's the part that he says should not be audited. And is that what you're talking about when you say that every financial organization of any kind gets audited?
Every financial organization gets audited, yes. And what Mr. Bernanke is saying, that, yes, the
the operations are being audited, but not the policy is being audited. And the thing is, everything needs to be audited. And all accounting entities also have their policies audited as well. It's called the financial statement. You know, it's called the executive letter. The executive summary is the is where the CEO of a company comes out and tells the shareholders, this is what we're doing, this is what our plans are, where we think we went wrong, this is where we think we're going in the future. And the Federal Reserve doesn't provide anything like that, except for these testimonies. And the thing is, they need to let the numbers bear out. They need to have some independent people come in there and actually evaluate the policies and show whether or not they've got any impact on the overall economy, which we already know they do.
Now, of course, Mr. Bernanke would say, well, the last thing you want is to have a bunch of politicians imposing their political viewpoints on monetary policy, and that's what you would end up with, he says, if you have a situation where government auditors come in and review monetary policy.
Okay,
personally, I agree with you, but that's basically...
Well, yeah, but the politicians wouldn't be going in there and do it. They would appoint a independent third party to do it. I mean, so it's ridiculous to believe it, to say that the politicians would be the ones doing the audit. You'd get a third party to do it.
And ultimately, what we have here is a quasi centralized monetary system authorized by the government through the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, delegating it to this independent organization, or quasi-independent organization, created by the banks and staffed by the government. And by staff, I mean at the upper echelons. And that this organization is given the control of monetary policy, but so far, for the first 100 years or so, that control has been largely unoverseen, shall we say, by the government that gave them the authority in the first place. So what we're talking about here is basically taking that power back into the government. Now, the question I raise here, and this is, I don't want to be perceived as being on Mr. Bernanke's side, because I'm not, but it does raise a question in my mind. Can we trust the people in the bureaucratic circles any more than we can trust the private bankers when it comes to deciding what this monetary policy is?
No, unfortunately, because if we're talking about high-level auditors, we're talking about high-level government officials, we're talking about investment bankers or members of the FASB, the Financial Accounting Oversight Board, these are all people who benefit greatly personally from the current system. So asking them to come up with an independent, unbiased report would be counterproductive to their own careers.
And so that brings us back to the question, Jake, I'm going to come back to you, the original question, which is one we haven't really voiced here in quite some time, but that is, why did Ron Paul come up with this idea of audit the Fed? Because if it doesn't ultimately change the discomfort, shall we say, that we have with a central authority controlling the money supply, what does it actually accomplish? And Jake, I'm sure you have a view on that, so what do you think?
Yeah, and it's important. It's interesting how over time the Fed has changed strategies. When this bill, the bill first came out very, very long time ago, but at that time there was really only one co-sponsor on the bill. Nobody else cared. And then after the kind of the 2008 fallout was the first time that they got the bill through, but they mutated it enough so that they really just were reporting on what happened during the meltdown of 2008. And when that came out, you know, it was trillions of dollars being loaned out to a lot of overseas and predominantly European banks. We were literally bailing out the European banking system as well as the American banks. But so that was very important and was kind of kept under wraps for quite a few years. But, you know, at the time, the Fed's line was, oh, we already do an audit. We already do an audit. You can see it. You can go to the website. You can look at it. But it's not, as Bill is highlighting, it's not a true audit. It's not going through, for instance, all their off-the-balance sheet transactions, which is most likely enormous, and secondly, most likely pretty shocking. And I think that's, you know, there's a reason why, people that government entities or quasi-governmental entities, that's really what the central bank is, seek to hide things. And, you know, I mean, just take a look at the Republican candidate for president, Mr. Romney. You know, he's hiding everything except for, like, his last year of tax returns. His wife just came out on some talk show saying, you have everything you need to know, which, you know, pretty much means that there's some pretty highly inflammatory stuff in his past tax returns, because every presidential candidate, including Mitt Romney's father back in the 60s, released multiple years of tax returns. So they've got something to hide. That's why they're resisting. All their complaints to the contrary is really has no effect on things overall. It makes no sense. Like, even all their monetary policy discussions are released after a hold on the time period. Because you could make an argument that, you know, on the day something's released, you know, when they release their Federal Open Market Committee meeting minutes, you could say, well, maybe if they know what's, you know, going to happen next, you give an unfair advantage to somebody else, which is just a shame, because it just proves that the manipulation of the interest rates and the manipulation really increases of the money supply that the Fed is responsible for causes, you know, market chaos, and really it's to the detriment. You know, it's we could definitely live without a central bank. There's no need to have somebody deciding what interest rates are, and when you let banks do it, you know, we have the whole LIBOR banking scandal where they're fixing the interest rate. So,
yeah. Well, you mentioned,
and I'll tell you who's got the unfair advantage. It's Goldman Sachs. Because half their people are on the board of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Well, it's all those companies, and you can go back to, like, the phone log transfers, and you can tell, you know, like, back in 2008, Paulson was on the line consistently with the heads of J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs to, you know, for the bailout, and it's, you know, it's pretty naive to, you know, think that who's Geithner is, I think he was just out saying some pretty funny stuff the other day as well. It's naive to pretend that he's not on the line with the banks as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole LIBOR thing is obviously the second stage of our conversation here today, because it's now beginning to seep out into the public that there may actually be a central bank role in this. No surprise to us here, but perhaps a surprise to much of the rest of society. A couple of notes that came out this week. It is now up to 5 states that are independently pursuing their own LIBOR manipulation investigations. It's now New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Florida, and Maryland in various stages of investigating, according to a number of sources that were cited by Bloomberg. And in addition to this, there is, like you were alluding to a minute ago there, Jake, there's the Geithner connection, where apparently during his tenure as the head of the Federal Bank of New York, there were conversations with their colleagues overseas about how to handle certain situations. In fact, there are there's one particular memo, I guess you might call it, not memo, I guess it's a phone conversation transcription that appeared on businessinsider.com. I think it originally comes from Bloomberg, but I'm not sure exactly where it comes from. But basically, it's a one-sided conversation where the British side of the conversation is going to all these details about how LIBOR is being manipulated, and the Federal Reserve person is saying, yep, uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. It's a really interesting transcript. But it does point to the fact that there is apparently a connection. This is the second time we're seeing a central bank connection. We've previously seen it in the testimony that took place over in Britain, where there is a connection between Barclays Bank and the Bank of England, and that was where the initial LIBOR manipulation conversations took place. Now we're seeing this with the Federal Reserve, and I think by the time we're done, we're going to find that all the central banks, the major ones around the world, were involved with this thing. So back to the theme that I keep liking to bring up here, isn't this really not so much about controlling LIBOR or for the profit of the banks, but rather for controlling the monetary system itself, or basically exercising monetary policy? And this is a viewpoint that's not shared shared by most of the financial public. But, Bill, since I haven't really run it by you, I'm going to run it by you here. What do you think? Is there a connection there? Are the central banks actually using LIBOR as a way to exercise not monetary policy?
I would think so. I mean, the evidence seems to be pointing in that direction. I see that the it's obvious that the LIBOR was manipulated by the European banks, and the ECB had to have known about it because they were the ones who were collecting the data. I mean, it was a lot like it. They couldn't see a pattern here that more than one bank over there were giving same rates and whatever. It wasn't even perceived competition at that point. Everybody, you can't get that kind of agreement without collusion.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jake, we're even getting more information today about more investigations coming from Europe. I know you dug up the details about that. What do you have?
Right. Well, the way that the LIBOR is calculated on, Barclays paid, I think, a half a billion dollar settlement to the government, although, like I commented when the story first came out, the government really aren't the folks that got ripped off. It's everybody else whose interest rates on their car loans or home loans or whatever were affected by that particular settings. So, but, the way the LIBOR is set is it's a survey, a poll taken of a bunch of banks, but they toss out the high and the low results. So even if Barclays was, rigging their numbers really high or really low, depending on what they wanted to do with their own trading against their own customers, it wouldn't really necessarily affect. It would get tossed out. So by, having them found guilty of this, ergo, there must be other banks involved. And sure enough, coming out on Bloomberg today, traders at Deutsche Bank, HSBC Holdings, Societe Generale, the monstrous French bank, Credit Agricole, which I believe is also a French bank, are also under investigation, along with Barclays is continuing. So the investigators are focusing on their links to a former ex-trader at Barclays who is found that was part of this whole rigging of the euro and the LIBOR offer rates. So the it shouldn't really be too much of a surprise that there's other entities involved, and there's a lot of interesting discourse going on with the Bank of England being told, hey, nobody talked about this at all, and the Fed and the CFTC saying that, we found some stuff, a long time ago, and yeah, we ignored it.
What I found also funny today was when Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley sues these other banks for manipulating the LIBOR. It was hilarious. It was they're suing them because they manipulated the LIBOR because what was it? They weren't allowed to play in their sandbox. So now we're going to sue you for it. It was.
Well, they got left out.
Yeah, they got left out. So we're going to sue you for it now. and to believe that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were not involved in some way, even if they were just tacitly agreeing, is laughable considering how ingrained they are in monetary policy throughout the world. And here they are opening up this lawsuit as if to say to the world, hey, look, we were involved in this one, so, we're going to cash in on it. We're going to cash in on all the bad publicity.
Well, actually, J.P. Morgan has to find some way to make up for their huge trading loss. Maybe that's what this is about. But seriously, I mean, Jake, you were alluding to the fact that they could either be manipulating the rate up or manipulating the rate down. So far, what we've seen coming out in various media reports and testimony and so forth is that they were trying to manipulate the rate down. And, in fact, I even saw one commentator, I think over at Fox, pointing out that was actually good for homeowners and so forth because it was keeping their mortgage payments down. But I think there's a more important underlying point there, and that is I think the central bankers and the top financial people of the world were seeing the entire system coming apart at its seams before September 2008. They saw it was happening. I think they saw it a few years before. And I think that what was actually happening is that they were saying, we've got to keep those rates down because if they start rising too high, then every credit system in the world is going to freeze up, as it did in 2008. And when that happens, all heck is going to break loose.
Right. And
well, we've got to stop that now.
Right, and just for our listeners, you know, what a rising LIBOR means is that the interest rates that they're charging each other, like if a bank needs to borrow money from another bank, is the, that interest rate is continuing to go up, and that, like you said, really inferred, that's what generates a lot of fear. So, you know, if the banks are getting worried, you know, the people should be much more worried than the banks.
Well, what struck me as strange here too is why are American mortgage adjustable mortgages affected by a European benchmark?
Well, because that's the way the contracts are written. That's the obvious answer, but it's a great question.
Yeah, well, and I guess that's another reason why I guess Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs are upset, because they were by artificially pushing that LIBOR rate low, they were screwed out of some interest income.
Yeah, but not only for them, but for their clients that they had been selling these derivatives to, that they were, you know, counting on them to make them lots of money.
Yeah, and then on the flip side, people were like, well, if the LIBOR rate wasn't kept so low, then more people would have been, you know, foreclosed on, and the housing crisis would be a lot worse than it actually was. And so, it doesn't make any sense why Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley would be, you know, suing the banks for manipulating LIBOR when actually they, in essence, saved their own skin. You know, they helped them by not doing so many foreclosures.
Right, and add in the fact that since the overall desire was to keep the interest rates low, to not let them rise the way the market would normally let them rise, because of a fear that it would freeze up the credit system, this takes me back to what we continuously hear from Ben Bernanke whenever he's questioned about, well, how are we going to climb out of this huge monetary base increase that we've created by buying up all these bad mortgages and buying all these sovereign debt and all this other kind of stuff. When we finally need to start raising the interest rate, well, that's going to affect everybody.
Yeah.
And yet that's the way that he's proposing that we're going to stop the craziness, that the inflation, the huge price inflation that follows when you have that kind of monetary base increase. He says, he acknowledges tacitly it's going to happen at some time, but we can stop that by raising the interest rates. And yet the LIBOR scandal is showing us very clearly there was very little tolerance for interest rate increases during the period from 2005 to 2008, when supposedly the economy was growing like crazy. Actually, it was in recession when you take inflation and factor it out. But the way they measure GDP was supposedly a booming economy. If we can't handle interest rates going up during that period, how in the heck do we handle it during this period? That's the part I don't see.
Yeah, and by keeping them below and keeping inflation rates below, keeping the interest rates below inflation, they're essentially losing money on these loans.
But if they raise it up to where inflation is going to be, then people can't afford them anymore.
Exactly.
Oh, we've got some fun times ahead of us.
Yes, we certainly do.
No doubt about it. Well, some of the other things that have happened as a result of the fallout from all this, of course, is the ongoing struggle in Europe to maintain the various states staying afloat without going under a huge avalanche of sovereign debt. And we're seeing news coming out this week that both Spain and Italy are experiencing more difficulties. Surprise, surprise. Spain, in fact, their 10-year bond rising above that magical 7% figure. I think just yesterday, and Moody's cut the company ratings on a whole bunch of Italian banks. So two of the countries that have been featured in this ongoing struggle to see if they can keep the euro held together by bailing wire and chewing gum, it's falling apart in front of our eyes. Bill, I'm going to go to you on this one. What do you see happening with the PIGS countries? Are they going to tear the euro apart sooner rather than later, or is there going to be a massive monetary expansion that's going to save the euro at the last second and basically help destroy Europe even faster?
I came out like 6 months ago, and I said, by the end of the first quarter, I'm seeing total monetary collapse because I can't see it going beyond the first quarter. Well, the first quarter came and went, and then the second quarter came and went. And I'm constantly impressed at the collective the self-delusion of the markets. They it's amazing that when there's even a rumor of further stimulus, the markets go up and things and everyone's all happy and things get appear to be more stable. So what I see, even with the interest rates above 7%, whatever, if the ECB comes out and says, no, no, we're not going to let this you know, get any worse, we're going to do some further stimulus and whatever, the markets will then stabilize and we'll keep 7%, and or maybe even the interest rate will even go down and they'll be able to actually sell some of that debt. And it's amazing that, that it'll just keep on going and going and going, and they're just going to make the they're just adding more fuel to this this hydrogen bomb that's going to eventually explode.
And it's becoming really clear that what all the major traders are doing is they're riding whatever the latest financial authorities are hinting at. So if Bernanke hints that there's not going to be any particular movement toward another stimulus, as they call it, then the market subsides a little bit. But if there's a rumor that some Federal Reserve governor says, well, we're going to have to do something soon, then it rises again. Or if the ECB president says, well, we got to start thinking more in terms of monetizing based on bonds, then it rises again. But if there's going to be more austerity, then it falls a little bit. I mean, it's like they're watching everything that the top financial figures are saying, and that's basically what's driving the market.
Yeah. And it's not even like they're even setting policy. Ben Bernanke doesn't have to say another word for the rest of the year and just let the rumor mill fly, and the markets will do the same thing that they're doing right now.
And, Jake, we know that's got to work out bad in the long run. I mean, there's absolutely no way that that can sustain itself for very long. Eventually, that's got to collapse.
Well, that's what we think, and you know, certainly, I think you know, during the 1970s, that was kind of like a partial collapse, which was somewhat stopped by the Fed cranking up interest rates at one point to like 20% on the T-bond. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen again. If they try to do that, the amount of debt that's out there is so massive, and a lot of the maturity is so short that it most likely wouldn't work. So what's the alternative? And the alternative is kind of what they've been doing since 1913 and even before, which is print money, throw money at it and keep trying to delay it. And I think it was Bill that said, you know, the system's all kind of tied together. In the past, you know, 1800s, even 1900s to some degree, if you had individual bank failures, the whole system would be better off for it, because the people that were still keeping their money in a bank that was insolvent would learn better. At this point, we were just bailing out everything. So what's going to happen when the Apple or when everything kind of crumbles? You know, the whole thing's got to go down. So it's it's just like, I think call it a hydrogen bomb, but it's just becoming more and more dangerous the longer this whole musical chair game continues.
Yeah, absolutely true. Well, we're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about how this has been playing out here within this country, particularly with the housing crisis that came with 2008 and thereafter, and what's been happening as a result of that, because it's been fallout at both ends of the age spectrum, and we have different stories to look at on that score. Plus, we're going to take a look at what's happening over in Syria. Syria's top ruler is being challenged, in fact, a major attack there, so we're going to go into some details about that as well. Plus, we even have a couple of good feel-good stories to top things off. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Run back to your dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, Bill G. coming at you here on this Thursday, July 19, 2012. And as mentioned before the break, lots of things happening over in Syria because a suicide bomber has basically shaken up the entire political structure over there. There's a lot of talk now about civil war. In fact, drawing from an article in Reuters that was entitled Deadly Blast Strikes Heart of Assad's Rule, basically points out that the suicide bomber tore apart the inner circle because the people killed were kin. They were relatives who were also at the top of the power hierarchy. They were the ones who were killed and injured in this blast. So this is a blast, unlike many suicide bombs, this is a suicide bomber who actually managed to go at the heart of power, presumably according to rumor, because he either was a bodyguard or he had a tie to a bodyguard, and that's how he got so close. But this is something that's really shaking up not just Syria but the Middle East. Syria has always been a relatively somewhat semi-unstable power within the Middle East. This definitely makes them more unstable and raises a lot of questions about how the whole power structure of the Middle East is going to shake out. But Jake, you have some news about what I believe Russia has to say in the situation. I guess there was a UN a resolution on it. What are the details on that?
Right. They are. The UN was, pretty much probably at the U.S. behest of the United States. Threatening sanctions against Syria's leaders who are, pretty much murdering their own people. However, Russia and China, both of them, have vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that would have taken a step along that. This is from the Wall Street Journal. It was the third time Russia and China vetoed a resolution intended to pressure the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to leave power. The failure of the latest diplomacy points to a growing likelihood that Syria's fate will be decided by bloody clashes in the streets of the capital and not in the halls of the UN. That's a direct quote from Wall Street Journal. And the British did draft this resolution. It was co-sponsored by the United States, France, and Germany. It would have given the Syrian government 10 days to withdraw troops and heavy weapons from populated areas or face sanctions targeted at the regime's elite. It wasn't specified in the resolution. The threatened sanctions were to have included asset freezes and international travel restrictions on senior Syrian officials. South Africa and Pakistan decided to abstain. The Chinese ambassador said China vetoed it because it had uneven content intended to put pressure on only one party, unquote. He said that if passed, the resolution would, quote, aggravate the turmoil and cause spillover to other countries in the region, unquote. He also called the West, quote, rigid and arrogant, unquote. So as this travesty kind of continues, it's, for certain, probably Assad is trying to, make sure he doesn't go the way that Libya, Muammar Gaddafi went, where the NATO started just coming in there and bombing. And again, that was just supposed to be a no-fly zone. It quickly led to just flat-out bombing of the country by the NATO forces. So
yeah, absolutely. And this is something that is not just having geopolitical consequences around the world, but it's also having tremendous consequences for people living in the region. In fact, Bill, you passed a note to me about some rather personal notes, people you know in the region and their take on what's going on. What do you have for us?
Well, one of my best friends who that works with me, she's an American citizen, but she was born and raised in Libya, and she goes back every year or two to go visit with her family, and actually she just came back last week. So,
wow.
She was right there on the front lines, to be honest, when she said that in Lebanon itself, and because she was in Beirut, and you wouldn't think there was a war going on. the life is just going on as normal. I mean, granted, there were some places that you don't go, but because the security situation is obviously a little more heightened. But for the most part, this is just something they're used to. This is their life. This is their you mentioned that the possibility of NATO going in there, and that would definitely be a extremely unwelcome addition to the conflict right now, because at least from the Lebanese point of view, They would prefer it if the Syrians work this out on their own. I mean, they have no love for Assad or any or his regime or what they've been doing to the people there, but they are even more dead set against Western involvement because they see any amount of Western involvement is also involving Israel, and they would rather die than allow Israel any role in a post-Syria. Post-Assad Syria regime. That would be a fate worse than death. I mean, just to illustrate the point there, when I asked her when she was, you know, leaving for Lebanon, I said, okay, well, let's say, you know, the worst happens here and the conflict spills down over into Lebanon, and you can't get out through Syria. What was that?
No, I have a voicemail that's coming in. It's interfering with the broadcast here. But the question that comes to my mind here is just a few years ago, Lebanon was in the position that Syria is in right now. Lebanon was the one that was the country that was racked with violence, and Syria was kind of in the same role that Lebanon's in right now. So it's kind of a reversal of roles compared to a few years ago. And I can't help but imagine that impacts the Lebanese viewpoint on the situation.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, my friend was there during that conflict. She had to escape with her life, and with the Israelis coming in there, and which is another reason why she has absolutely no love for the Israelis, because she witnessed war crimes committed by the Israeli army, blowing up ambulances and stuff like that. I mean, she was completely shaken by this, and she escaped through Syria with that particular conflict. Mm-hmm. So definitely, and I asked her, you know, if you're faced with a situation here where the violence spills over, where would you go? I mean, you can't escape through Syria this time.
Right.
How would you escape? And she said, I would try and get out through Cyprus. She even said that she would consider going through Iraq rather than going through Israel.
Wow.
You know, and this is an American citizen here, so you'd think that an American citizen could go through Israel and have no problem. She said absolutely not, because she's Lebanese. She would rather die than go through Israel. There's a very clear line of demarcation here.
Yeah, at least for the Lebanese, there certainly is one. And I suppose that same line of demarcation applies to most of the rest of the Middle East. The other thing that catches my attention here, I remember seeing on cable, one of those Food Network, I think it was, or one of those secondary networks, Anthony Bourdain. He's a chef. He goes around and, you know, samples the food of the world. And he was in Lebanon at the time that Israel was attacking. And it turned into a very traumatic event for him and his crew. They barely got out with a great deal of assistance at a time when other people weren't getting out. And instead of reporting on the food, his report basically became a commentary and a travelogue on what it's like to live in a war zone and to have the U.S. Marines come and pull you out. So that's one of the things that catches my mind. The other thing that catches my mind is this is nothing new. I mean, I don't mean just over the last 30, 40 years. These kinds of tussles have been going on in the Middle East literally for centuries. And you mentioned, Bill, that it's almost like their normal heightened state of awareness that they're used to all the time. We're not talking about used to over the last few years. We're talking about it really for centuries. This has been ongoing for generations.
Exactly. In fact, there was she was also describing to me she has a cousin over there, and this was just after a senior Lebanese official, one of the Christian ruling class. Was kidnapped and shot by one of the a Hezbollah militia group, and it created a great deal of instability. And this happened blocks away from their house, and they had a party. And that night, he had a party on his roof that he was planning on. You know, this was a party that he planned on having with a bunch of his friends for months. And he had the party anyway. It was on the rooftop, and you know, and you think something like that happens here, and everyone would be, you know, locking their doors and breaking out their guns and getting ready for Armageddon. And over there, it's just, you know, it's just life.
Yeah, just part of the party, really.
Yeah.
Okay, are the bombs stopped? Okay, turn on the music.
Yeah.
Different lifestyle entirely.
It different, yes.
Well, on to a more sad note, we were talking for the first half of the show about both central banking and the LIBOR manipulation scandal and how it ties in with the financial crisis of 2008 and the aftermath. Of course, in this country, the big aftermath has been the impact on homeowners, how many millions of homeowners have lost their homes, how many more millions are currently either behind on their payments or on their payments, but living in houses that are what they call underwater. Basically, the houses are worth a lot less than what the mortgages are worth. And some of the victims of this whole financial mess have largely been not ignored, but certainly underreported. An example of this came from Bloomberg this week. They have a report that's entitled Housing Crisis Sees 1.5 Million Older Americans Lose Their Homes. And just want to read a little bit from that. First paragraph basically repeats it, saying more than 1.5 million Americans aged 50 or more have lost their homes since the collapse of the housing market in 2007 as delinquency rates and foreclosures soar. According to advocacy group AARP, about 3.5 million loans, or one in six to people in the age group, had balances that were higher than the value of the property being purchased as of December, according to a report by Lori Trawinski for the Washington-based lobby. She says more older Americans are carrying mortgage debt than in the past, and the amount of that debt is also increasing. Their economic situation is worsening. This is a significant change in this country, because up until even 10 years ago, perhaps even 5 years ago, it was commonplace for people to assume that by the time they're in their so-called golden years, in their retirement years, the mortgage is paid off, basically all of their debts are paid, they have their retirement income that they're living on, and you know, they've got their assets, they can travel, they can do all that kind of stuff. That's changed dramatically in just the last 5 years. And Jake, I don't really see that being reflected a great deal in the media today, but I've got to think that's going to start becoming a big ongoing story in the years to come, especially now that the baby boomers are reaching and going into their retirement years.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, the demographics of the country are changing very quickly. It doesn't take much. All you have to do is look at some of the charts that like Social Security puts out, and you'll get quite a bit alarmed.
Well, you're very alarmed. And in fact, if you're in that group, I'm actually in the boomer group, and I have to admit, I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to survive in my retirement years. But this is becoming not just a question of housing. This is just becoming an overall economic question for a major portion of society, which still has a very large portion of the vote. And Bill, I'm not sure what your take is on this, but my take is this is a problem that's got to get worse a lot faster than people will expect it. People were talking about, you know, Social Security not becoming a crisis until 2016 to 2018, depending on who you listen to, Medicare not being a crisis until, you know, 2018, 2020, depending on who you listen to. But add in this situation with the housing market, I see this happening as a crisis a lot sooner than everybody else is thinking. What do you think?
I agree with you. It's amazing. My grandmother is one of those people who was able to live a fairly comfortable retirement and whatever. But then you look at my parents, who take care of my grandmother full time. Yes, they're able to take care of her because she had some assets left over from my grandfather. But my parents have two mortgages, and they are not seeing, you know, really a lot of retirement income. And they're in their mid-60s now. And then you look at my generation that's coming up next. We're, you know, living in underwater houses, and we have nothing for retirement, and we got a student loan debt, debt burden, which prevents us from even building equity over the long term. I mean, we can't even get started.
Right. Yeah, it's an insane situation all the way around. There's no doubt about that. The other thing that strikes me about it is the fact that these people who make up this large voting bloc, up until this point, have basically been supporters of the entire monetary system, the entire government approach to that monetary system, the stimuluses of the economy over the last 20, 30 years and so forth. And they don't seem to have made the connection yet. They're starting to, but they don't seem to have made the connection between what they've been supporting all this time and the consequences that are being created for them now. And yet I don't see how those consequences can be avoided at this point.
I wish they could make those connections, because I keep trying to provide those connections, especially to my parents, and it's very difficult to get them out of that. I mean, to them it's a question of monetary policies or even government policies that affect them directly, like the Social Security, gun laws, the social agendas and stuff like that, and what they fail to see is how they're just completely screwed over the long term, and they will. I mean, if they're lucky enough to die with, just a smidgen of debt, they'll have nothing to pass over to their children. I look at my own life, and I look at my son just turned 4, and there's absolutely no way I'm going to be able to provide him with anything. He is so completely on his own, and it breaks your heart. And yes, these are large voting blocks, but as long as the mass media continues to feed the big lie to the masses, they're going to continue to vote, Republican, Democrat. And, you hear the latest poll is that it's 46% Obama, 47% Romney. Well, where's everybody else? That's all. I mean, here it is. We're mid-July. The election isn't until November. And you're telling me that the electorate is that split over two candidates who both basically have the same platform?
Or to put it another way, there's only 7% who aren't willing to sign on with either boat.
There's only 7% out there that are making the connection that there's something seriously wrong here.
It's part of an ongoing thing that says, well, you have to pick one of the two. If you don't, then you haven't done your civic duty.
Yeah, and I go with George Carlin with that one. If I don't vote, then I have every right to complain because I didn't vote for the idiot that went into the office.
That's right. And more idiocy and more sadness where the housing crisis is concerned. Another article, this one coming from Reuters, reporting on a study that found, not surprisingly, a correlation between the housing crisis and child abuse. This is really both, not surprising and quite sad. Let me read a little bit from it. This came out just 2 days ago. U.S. hospital admissions for child abuse have risen in the past decade, and the increase may be related to the housing crisis of recent years, a study suggests. Researchers found that between 2000 and 2009, admissions for physical abuse at U.S. pediatric hospitals peaked in 2008, right about the time housing foreclosures were taking off in many parts of the country. In general, as a local area's rate of delinquent mortgages and housing foreclosures rose, so did its rate of child abuse admissions, according to the findings. That doesn't prove the housing crisis is to blame, however, because there's no way from this kind of a study to actually draw a direct cause and effect correlation. It's merely just there's a statistical correlation here that we're noticing. In fact, the article also went on to note later on that there is not a similar correlation between rising child abuse and unemployment, which is really counterintuitive in some ways and kind of interesting. But nevertheless, clearly there are going to be fallout whenever you have hard economic times, and perhaps what's happening with the housing crisis and the lost homes and so forth, maybe that's where the proverbial straw is breaking the camel's back, and that's why the abuse is going up. Bill, let's go to you first. What are your views? What's actually driving the connection?
I think what's driving the connection here is just a feeling of groundedness and instability. And when you feel unstable, then that breeds instability. And there's a counter argument here that parents who own their own homes and are stable and whatever, those kids have a tendency to do better on standardized tests. Well, again, that's a big duh. If you've got a supportive household, you're not worrying about whether or not you're going to actually have a roof over your house, yes, you're going to have a more well-rounded and more stable environment. So to me, the study was actually a the correlation was one of those big duh moments for me. It was of course there's going to be a rise in child abuse as a result.
And Jake, did you want to weigh in on this one before we moved on?
We can move on.
Okay. Well, I'm going to bring you in on the next one, because one of the solutions, so-called, that have been proposed, and it has at least some interesting side to it, it has been coming out of California over the past week. The idea coming out of some municipalities that perhaps the municipality should use the power of eminent domain to seize mortgages and to basically use that as a vehicle for reducing the mortgage principal. It's getting a lot of attention, not surprisingly, a lot of negative attention from the banks, a lot of positive attention from local citizens and clientele and people who are finding themselves under the water, under the burden of these mortgages. Jake, I don't know if you had any chance to look at this in detail, but what do you think? Is this something that's just a half-cocked idea, or does it have some merit to it?
Well, the use of eminent domain to seize property from, whether it's a person or a bank, that just doesn't make any sense. I think that itself is unlawful. I think people would tend to have sympathy for, someone that, took a mortgage that they couldn't afford or whatever. But I think that, people should recognize that if you allow the government to take money away, or to take property away from a bank, they're also going to take property away from you. And, in a lot of ways, a lot of states already do that through property taxes and school taxes. Here in eastern Pennsylvania, the costs are, of paying that if you own a home are astronomical, ranging from, depending on how large your house is, of course, but $2,000 to $7,000 a year, which is just nuts on top of everything else, all the other taxes that government takes. So, yeah, just like everyone, I have sympathy for people that, can't pay off their mortgage and that type of thing. But, they did sign a contract. On the flip side of it, we know where the money came from. The money was created out of thin air, or most of it, by the banks in order to lend out. So it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of a fraudulent contract that's been executed. And, It's a touchy way to go about it. I definitely wouldn't use eminent domain. That's all I can say.
Bill, would you use?
Yeah, my question is, how are they going to pay for it? I mean, municipal governments have thin budgets to begin with, and they're going to be using their municipal budgets to pay for this. My guess is the answer is no. They're probably going to take out a muni bond for it, a municipal bond, and try and get investors to bear the downside risk of that, which we already know how the municipal bond market is in shambles right now, and how successful that'll be.
Well, I mean, if they're using eminent domain to seize the mortgage is basically the lien on the property separated from the loan itself. So if they're using the eminent domain to seize the mortgage, how is that creating the expense for the counties or the towns or the cities?
Well, are they telling the banks you're not getting paid because we're using eminent domain?
Because they have not been clear about that.
Doesn't the Fifth Amendment promise just compensation for seizure of property?
Actually, the way eminent domain is normally exercised, it's the government that decides what is the fair compensation. So it would really be up to the towns and counties to decide what's fair compensation for the mortgage. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to say that the people who took out the mortgages don't have to pay their loans back. It just means that you can't seize the houses anymore, and we have to figure out what the value of that is.
Okay, well, there's ultimately going to be a dollar value attached to it.
Because they just
can't tell the banks, we're not paying your loan, we seized this property, you're not getting your money.
Well, yeah, remember what eminent domain is supposed to be used for. It's supposed to be like, you know, if the government needs to build a vital fort. And
yes.
Very little other uses of it, really.
Well, this is the interstate highway system within a minute to mean, too.
Well, yeah, same thing. So, and well, that was put in a lot of ways for, you know, moving tanks around and that sort of thing. But
yeah.
That's, you know, the government can kind of rationalize it however it wants. You know, to say, oh, well, a municipality can exercise their own domain and take property away from a person or a bank or a company,
yeah, there's no national security interest here.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. I just wanted to throw in one little feel-good story because there's not really time to go into it, but apparently one of the largest spam networks in the world has been taken down. So if you see less email spam coming into your email accounts in the days and weeks ahead, gentlemen, you'll know why. There was a group of security officials who took down a series of servers around the world, and now that spam network is no more. Unfortunately, they could go out and create another spam network. But for the moment, we have less spam. And that's about it. That's about all the time we've got. But, Bill, thank you once again for sitting in for Gene, and we'll have you back again.
Thank you.
And Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual. We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. I started to turn, talking about everything.